Monster Man, Episode 133, Svirfneblin to Symbiotic Jelly. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we are coming to the long-awaited end of our journey through the S chapter of The Fiend Folio, the 1981 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. We're going to be talking about the Svirfneblin and the Symbiotic Jelly, and they're a very interesting contrast in two styles of monster, so let's get started. First up, we have the Svirfneblin. The Svirfneblin are basically gnomes, they're called deep gnomes, and they live underground. I think most gnomes live underground, but they live way down underground in what would come to be known as the Underdark. They're created by Gary Gygax, and they originally appeared in a scenario, Shrine of the Kuotoa, which explains things like the references to Kuotoa in the Svirfneblin description. I'm assuming that this description is ported more or less straight over from the scenario, but I don't have a way to check. Svirfneblin are not bad guys per se. They're basically just this culture. They live underground. They're into all the things that you would expect an underground culture to be, you know, mining and so on. They are gnomes, so they have illusionist type powers. Even the ones who aren't illusionists per se have some kind of camouflage and stealth powers. And they also may have the ability to summon earth elementals to fight alongside them. They're very much built from the perspective that they would be somewhat tricky allies, right? They have rivalries which you can exploit as long as you're willing to offer them things that they want, whether that's, I don't know, just bribes, or the opportunity to get back at their traditional enemies such as the drow and the mind flayers. So once again, we're seeing this idea that D&D is developing an underground, not just ecosystem, but political system in which different factions with different agendas might be willing to support or oppose the goals of the player characters, which I think is interesting. And I don't know that that original series of modules, so a Vault of the Drow, Descent into the Depths of the Earth, Shrine of the Kuotoa, and what's the other one, Demon Web Pits, are intended to be like setting documents. You know, I think all that stuff was just created on an ad hoc basis. I just mean that what became kind of D&D's understood setting was inferred from these modules rather than intentionally created by them. The Svirfneblin are one of a group of monster types or creature types in D&D which are essentially dark reflections of an existing one. So, for example, the drow, the dark elves, and later on we're going to get the dwergar, who are dark dwarves. Now, the names drow and dwergar both come from Old Norse. They're Old Norse words for magical creatures of one kind or another. In keeping with that, one etymology that I've seen proposed for Svirfneblin is that it comes from the root word svart, which means dark or black, and Niflheim, which means fog, but which is sometimes cited as the origin for the name Nibelung, so that then the Nibelung are, you know, the dwarves or magical creatures that made the ring in the Ring of the Nibelungen, and Niflung in Old Norse mythology. So maybe Svirfneblin is kind of an attempt to create a word that that reminds one of, you know, dark gnomes or dark dwarves or something like that. I don't know. That's just something that I've seen suggested. I don't know that we have a conclusive source on the etymology of Svirfneblin. But anyway, it's definitely meant to sound kind of Old Norsey, which would be in keeping with those others. Also in keeping with later D&D monsters, and for one that was created, you know, intentionally to provide a challenge, possibly, for players in a scenario, or a useful asset to players in a scenario, the Svirfneblin are significantly buffer than their mainstream gnome counterparts. Presumably the idea being that you're not meeting just like regular old gnomes, you're meeting the soldiers of the Svirfneblin army, who are all, you know, 3-hit dice or better. In addition to their suite of magical powers, they also have some cool acid darts. I think one of the things that's really interesting about reading the Svirfneblin entry is comparing it to what a modern monster entry is like. Now, normally, talking about the Fiend Folio and comparing it to a modern book either means poking fun at a silly monster or grognardly griping about how things aren't as creative anymore. But I have to say that two columns of just text is not the most accessible way for this monster information to be presented, in particular because it's not like there's two columns of world background or evocative description is two columns of rules mechanics just presented in the form of paragraphs full of occasionally, you know, Gygaxian circumlocution. And as far as I can tell, these abilities are not in any particular order. So we go from summoning earth elementals to their illusion abilities to what kinds of weapons they carry to what their saving throws are like. This is a bit of a challenge when you get a creature whose stat block contains See Below. And See Below contains not only that information, but also quite a lot of references to other places. So you can see how, although in many ways it was presenting the same information, AD&D First did require quite a lot of prep, because it'll just tell you, like, oh, well, they save as if they were, you know, fighters of such and such a level. Well, no, now I gotta go look that up. And I assume that if you've been running AD&D for a while, then you know what that is. But I do wonder how many people, like, meticulously followed every reference in the monster entry, and how many people just kind of fudged it. That's what I would do, but I'm a very lazy DM, as we have established. I do think that the mechanical information in, say, the 5th edition Monster Manual is a lot more clearly presented, and if you want to argue that that comes at the loss of some flexibility and variety, then I won't disagree with you, but personally, I would find that easier to use. And I think this is a consequence of the fact that, I mean, we've talked about having one gimmick per monster. Really successful monsters tend to have a relatively small number of gimmicks. The Svirfneblin is not that they have gimmicks, just that it is an attempt to create not just a monster, but a society. And a society that exists within a very specific strategic context. And so therefore, there just is a lot of information to give out. It's not that the monster is over-designed, but that this format kind of struggles with presenting a lot of information. So a two-column long monster is quite long for the Fiend Folio. There are other ones, but you can see how the format of the monster book entry is starting to strain under the weight of all the information about Svirfneblin that Gary Gygax thinks you need. But in future, like, we're often going to see that information presented in a different way. So the setting comes through the monsters and the magic items and the scenarios and so forth. Not necessarily a bad way to do it, but you can see some of the challenges that they are learning to deal with as they go here. Once again, I have to call out the art by Russ Nicholson here. I don't particularly, like, I am in general not a fan of Drow, Dwergar, Svirfneblin. Like, I've said before that I feel like Drow kind of weaken the elves to me, because I don't see why they need to be a separate thing. Like, some elves are good, some elves are bad. The idea that there is a whole society of bad elves sort of implies that all the other ones are good, and I don't like that. But the Svirfneblin are alright in that respect. I really do like the fact, and that may just be because they're little short dudes with big noses, and they look kind of glum rather than grim, and I don't know, that's more of that Russ Nicholson pathetic aesthetic that we all love so much. Finally, we have the Symbiotic Jelly by Roger Musson. Now, I saw a reference the other day to someone talking about the Musson monsters, and I wonder what identifiable thread is supposed to run through Musson stuff, but I wonder if it's kind of just weirdness. Like I mentioned earlier, the idea that monsters should have a limited number of gimmicks. Well, the Symbiotic Jelly has quite a large amount of gimmick for such a small monster. So this is basically like a blob of magical or psychic jelly, and it goes and it finds itself a carnivorous creature. And what it does is it feeds off that creature. When that creature eats something, the symbiotic jelly kind of magically draws nutrition from it. And so what it does is it sets itself up in, let's say, a cave. And it lures in a monster of some, you know, it lures in, let's say, a bear. And it establishes a connection with that bear. And this allows it to do a couple of things. First, that means that if the bear eats something, the symbiotic jelly gets part of the nourishment. Secondly, it can use its illusory powers to disguise the bear as something else, something less threatening than a bear. You know, let's say a weasel. And thirdly, it can use its illusory powers to make it look like there's a bunch of treasure in the cave. So what happens is that, you know, adventurers come into the cave looking for the treasure. They're like, oh, it's just a weasel in here, we'll just chase it off. But they find themselves fighting a bear, and the bear eats them, and the symbiotic jelly gets the nourishment. Now, from a strictly ecological standpoint, this does not make a lot of sense. Roger Musson seems to be significantly overestimating the number of intelligent creatures wandering around the wilderness going into caves. If you have a society nearby that's like exploring caves looking for treasure, after the first couple of times that it turns out not to be a weasel, they're gonna figure it out. Imagine that you have you know, 4 or 5 hunters going into a cave looking for treasure. There's a weasel, and they like aim a swift kick at it. It turns out to be a bear and it claws them. Well, after a weasel suddenly mauls the first one to death, the others aren't going to be like, well, this is supposed to be a level balanced encounter. Let's get in there and get toe-to-toe with this super tough weasel. They're just going to run away, and they're going to tell everybody about the cave with the magic weasel in it. Now, maybe this is where the player characters get wind of this strange thing that's happened, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense as a survival strategy for the symbiotic jelly. What it should be doing is creating illusory, like, pools of fresh water, or illusory bushes rich with berries, or something like that, to lure in, you know, deer or rabbits, because I gotta say that adventurers, as a basis for a diet, make little sense in a dungeon environment, and even less in a wilderness environment. So first, I think you gotta tweak it just so that the symbiotic jelly's illusion produces a vision of whatever it is that the person wants to see, or the creature wants to see. So this should apply to animals and monsters as well, right? So not just treasure, but it just, you know, it projects. It's like a mirage, right? Oh, water after all these weeks of journeying or whatever. Secondly, I think it would be fun if we could change the symbiotic jelly's ability to charm monster into also an ability to charm person. Humans also eat meat. So there's no reason for you not to be like, we're looking for old Jenny the prospector. She set out from this town. She was supposed to go to that place and she never turned up. She must have gone missing somewhere along the way with her treasure map. Oh no. And so you go looking for her and you find out that now she lives in a cave with the symbiotic jelly, like pretending that she's an otter. And wildlife comes into the cave and she bashes them with her pickaxe and eats them up. And the symbiotic jelly gains nutrition from that. So I think it'd be fun if it could do it to people as well. Also means that it adds a second level of compulsion to player characters, right? Because if something goes into the cave and kills the bear, then the symbiotic jelly tries to charm it instead, right? Well, oh, that's better than a bear. I'm gonna get one of those. So it'd be fun if it could do that to player characters as well. So I think there is potential in the symbiotic jelly, but it's one of those cases where I think attempting to explain the life cycle of the monster just makes it extra confusing, because I was perfectly willing to accept that it doesn't make any sense, and is actually more difficult when the writer starts going, no, no, it does make sense, and here's why. And that is it for the S chapter of the Fiendfolio. Really felt like a long one, and I could look up how many monsters are in it, but I'm not going to. Instead, I want to take this moment before we wrap up to once again express my gratitude to all the listeners and supporters of Monster Man. We're coming to the end of the podcast's first full year, full calendar year of existence, and it's been incredibly rewarding. It makes me very happy that this, I mean, kind of niche idea is reaching so many people, and it makes me very happy to hear when they enjoy it. It's been a busy and stressful year in a lot of other ways, and that means that I am looking forward to taking a break for the next couple of weeks. So next week, Monster Man will not be on the air. Week after that, we'll be skipping Tuesday because that is New Year's Day, and I think I will be in no shape. But we will return, not next Friday, but the Friday after, January 4th. And when we do, we're going to talk about the Tabaxi and the Tentamort. In the meantime, I hope that you and all the people who are important to you have a safe and happy holiday. I'll see you in the new year on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons attribution license. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.